When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got!
Vincent.
Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is an extremely talented filmmaker where do I even start? I start with my favorite of their films is her 2019 Lingua Franca, which is the most readily available in Australia. This is actually what's terrible when I talk to a filmmaker whose work is so hard to get in Australia. It's almost like I want to do exactly what she did when she was an emerging cinephile and go to one of those huts in Asia where you can go and buy everything that is pirated, because that's the only way seemingly that you can get this stuff. But on Tubi in Australia, the incredible Lingua Franca is there. Director and writer of Senorita. Oh, sorry. Have you got a hint of where it's available in Australia? Your other stuff.
We're working on making it available. So you feel like you're Vincent Hanna and my filmography in Australia and Stephen Macaulay.
We are hunting it down. We're building dossiers. We're following people. We're scouring it out. We're trying to find it. And if you've got a VPN, that's the other great way to access this filmmaker's work. But being extremely selective right now with One Heat Minute, it's such a cherished podcast in our suite of podcasts that we've done. And so it really takes a while for me to get this, you know, magnificent car out of the driveway to talk about Heat again. And usually it's someone extremely special. And today that is exactly the case. This person that I'm talking to today wrote these words about their picks for the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll. Desire, Transgression, Seduction, the closest I've come to a spiritual possession. And if anyone knows anything about me, when you talk about Heat, I'm a man possessed. And this person put Heat on their list amongst Jan Dillman, amongst In the Mood for Love, Beau Travail, Holy Motors, an outstanding list. Isabel Sandoval, thank you so much for coming on to One Heat Minute.
Hey, Blake, I'm so excited and thrilled to be here. And to be honored among the luminaries that you have had so far on your show, both critics, you know, filmmakers, and other cinephiles.
You're an acolyte of Michael Mann, as Guillermo del Toro calls anyone who comes on this show. Once you're an acolyte of Michael Mann, it's just like it happens. But it's so great to talk to you. And it's, you know, at these times of things, I don't think there's ever a winner when you make a list of, like, when you're making a compiled list of, you know, I guess, what is canonically the best movies, I guess, generationally that we talk about, because everyone gets so really personal. And it's like, no, actually what's fun is going and looking at the individualists and seeing your favorite personalities, just like your favorite critics or your favorite filmmakers, what really tickles them, like what gets them excited, what inspires them. That's the fun. And so I think so much of the discourse is so tiresome, but then when it released, you know, the individual list, I was like, oh, this is great. Who's got Heat on their list? Yeah. And I believe you're like one of the only people that had Heat on their list that was released for the longest time. I think now it's, you know, in the hundreds, top 100 of all time based on all of the ones that are being released. But when yours became public, I think so many of now our mutual interactions, people that we talk to on Twitter, were all just like on that tweet and going, Isabel knows.
I want to, because they just released, you know, all the ballots, right? So I want to check out who actually voted for Heat or any Michael Mann film. I'm sure like Thief might have also gotten a few votes.
Yeah, maybe. The Insider, I think, is up there for a lot of people as well. But, you know, you're not to shout out and only because this is special, but Jason Bailey's great podcast, like A Very Good Year. You've just, your episode has just dropped on that. You had 1974, which I think is the most staggeringly stressful year, I think, to pick in movies. And you had outstanding picks, including probably my favorite of that year. I mean, it's so hard to say, but like Parallax View. So you're a massive Alan Pakula person as well. So it's so awesome to talk to you because I'm like, Pakula, man, I feel like our tastes are definitely aligned there because it's just really cool to see what filmmakers are starting to make the canon, just like Jan Delman. It's, you know, Ackerman being at the top of the list. It's exciting because it's like, okay, well, this is the new thing. This is the new exciting film that's at the top of the list.
Yeah. You know, I think between Jan Delman and Heat, I'm really a disciple of, and I'm fascinated with how so much can go on, you know, emotionally, psychologically, within a frame or within a scene, while there is no apparent action, you know, when we just see characters being like some of the most fascinating moments that, you know, I found in Heat are characters just ruminating and thinking.
Yes.
And, you know, kind of deliberating in their mind privately a decision that will, you know, affect, you know, the rest of their lives and that of the characters that they really care about. And that way it feels Chekhovian. You know, Chekhovian, and that typically in Chekhov, it might just be a family having, you know, dinner and having small talk. But in those very same moments, with a seemingly innocuous bit of dialogue, their lives can be, you know, torn apart or shattered or built up completely from ruin. And it's those, very sneakily substantial and very pivotal moments that take place, you know, within the pauses of the bigger action sequences that I'm really drawn to as a filmmaker. I'm really a minimalist. I mean, as you can see in Lingua Franca, and that is the, I think, aesthetic and dramatic direction I'm going in with my work moving forward. And in fact, you know, I already have announced a film, Tropical Gothic, that's a period drama, but I'm also currently developing a noir film, like, you know, something like a heist movie as well. And I was telling my co-screenwriter, I want to make something like Le Cercle Rouge or Heat or Drive.
Yes. You've just said all those things because I want to jump into about 10 of the things that you just said, but one of them is just that's the Chekhovian brilliance, especially if you see any of the work multiple times, and especially because this, by virtue of this show and by virtue, I think, of consuming your favorite things over and over again, I find myself going, where is the moment, where's the ramifications going to happen? And it's just like those tiny things, you know. We're not going to talk about this for the minute that we're going to cover and probably dive into a little bit more deeply to, you know, look through as the portal to Heat. But I just love Dennis Haysbert's character Don Breeden in this movie. And when you said that, I was just thinking, he's sitting there in the diner after in the bar after a horrible day at the diner. You know, Bud Cort is his terrible boss who's basically given him the red and the right act about what happens, I take your take-home pay, etc. And before his partner comes in, he's just sitting there looking despondent, drinking, just kind of like trying to put a glaze over his life. And you're like, you don't even have to, he doesn't have to have one word of dialogue. You never have to see him again, but you're like, this guy is not going to put up with this. He's not going to last. Like, he needs that person in his life to try and keep him straight and keep him on the straight and narrow. But you see him for 1 second and like the tears are welled up in his eyes and he's just wanting to throw everything away immediately. And you know, and I think that that's, you're 100% right. That actually makes the movie. I hate when people are like, oh, it's the slow bits and what, and you're like, no, the slow bits are the movie. I just want to dissuade. It's not the heist. It's all the things that happen before the heist. It's all the preparation. It's all those silent moments. It's always pauses for reflection. It's a rage reverse out of your driveway because you've had a fight with your wife because you're gambling on the Super Bowl again. It's everything. So I couldn't be more thrilled that you said, you know, three of those things, because Drive and Le Cercle Rouge, there's like 2 hours of each of those movies that are nothing to do with the heist. They're all of the in-between segments of the heist, and that's actually everything.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I'm not trying to, not the first one to think this, but his films, especially Thief and Heat, are kind of spiritual sequels, and also a very sophisticated and, you know, really interesting dramatic articulation of a fundamental Buddhist philosophy, you know, and principle of self-abnegation.
Yes.
Of relinquishing and detaching from material possessions and attachments in order to fulfill or achieve a kind of nirvana.
Yes.
And this is embodied, of course, in Thief, in the Frank character, by James Caan, and finds its, I guess, fullest realization in the character of Neil McCauley. And then in Thief, he's kind of like, you know, he's acquiring these relationships, you know, with Tuesday Weld, having a baby, starting a family. And at the end of the movie, he also just, you know, gives up all of those so he can pursue and achieve his mission of, you know, avenging himself. And in Heat, Neil gets close to it, literally, you know.
Yeah.
And you know that scene, and then pulls back at the very final moment. Nothing, you know, there's no dialogue exchange, but it is the most heartbreaking scene among, you know, some classic, you know, major heartbreakers in Heat. You know, it's really a dramatic, moving film. It's a lot of love stories that are happening, because man really invests those characters in relationship with, you know, the realism and the authenticity that we feel real emotions for these people, for these fictional characters, and especially two characters that are, you know, at their core, oppositional types, for us to care equally about both characters. I think that's the unique and really singular emotional aspect or quality that makes Heat a standout among action classics.
Yeah, because you, in all other movies that really try it, and there are some that do such a brilliant job with getting close, but it's, Michael Mann put it best in this way, and he's put it in many interviews this way. He's like, whoever you were watching on the screen, I wanted you to be with them, not just like superficially, but 100% in their headspace, in their mindset, and with them. When they're on screen, your goals are their goals. And when their oppositional forces are on screen, your goals are theirs. And so it's just that great kinetic energy of like being like, it's like watching, if you're a sports fan, it's like going, I love both of these teams and I kind of don't want either of them to lose. I just want to watch them play. And that's the whole brilliance of Heat, is that you're just like, oh my God, especially once these two guys go and get a cup of coffee together, you're like, just give me more of this. Yeah, any part of it. I want it. Oh my God. Well, look, partially because I just want the treat of actually watching something with you, because I think it would be such a fun thing. Yeah. We're going to dive into the 27th minute. Cue it up. We're going to look at a clip of this, and this is Isabel's request. We were talking, we were definitely going to touch on Thief in this conversation, but okay. Isabel said specifically, Blake, I want to talk about when Neil meets Edie. So that is where we are, 26 minutes into, I think it's the theatrical cut of Heat that most people have got. It's around this. It might be a second or two off, but you guys will hear it. You guys have a listen along. We're going to watch it together, and then we're going to come back and talk about this great, completely undervalued moment in this epic, but it is nonetheless brilliant.
You don't want to talk to me. It's okay. Sorry I bothered you.
I didn't mean to be rude. I didn't recognize you. I work in metals. I'm a salesman. My name's Neil.
I'm Edie.
You like working there?
Sure. I get a discount. There's a whole section of books in my area.
What area is that?
Graphic design. I do letterheads and logotypes at night, and the store's a day job till I get enough going.
Who do you do that for?
A restaurant. I did their menus and
We'll be back after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, it's a real treat just watching you, an extremely talented filmmaker, watch that with the glee that I'm watching that with. That was just such a treat. It's such a treat. So for people who are just listening, the masterful thing about this exchange is the camera choices, the positioning of the camera. First, an extremely kind of hostile two-shot, closed off shoulders, strained postures, and then this gorgeous, like whip pan around to reframe them to open Neil's chest up so that their relationship is that the body language completely changes and shifts. Sorry, my name is Neil. His hand goes out. And the last second that we're skating out of this shot into the beginning of the 28th minute is Neil picking up his coffee and his dinner and sliding it over so that he can sit one seat closer to Edie, and it is just so special. Tell me why you, Isabel, love this scene so much.
You know, this is in the same vein as the cab ride in Collateral.
Yeah.
You know, Mann is revered as an action director, but I don't think he gets enough credit for writing these very just incredible flirtation, you know, scenes. Yes. Between characters. I know he's like the serious version of Lubitsch in a way. Or and that, you know, his characters tend to be very kind of standoffish, lone wolf, you know, very committed to their passion or their job. And in first instance that they're meeting these women, and to see within that minute, and Neil McCauley, kind of the slow thawing of that, you know, that ice. And man is aided immeasurably by just another master at his craft with De Niro.
Yeah.
Who's, you know, very expressive, communicates as much, you know, with what he's saying, by, you know, the pauses and the hesitations and the just the thinking, you know, the processing that's going on in his head.
Yes.
That scene. And we see that shift, that turn, as you say, to kind of the opening up, you know, both with his body language and approaching Edie. And, you know, I know we only had 1 minute, but, you know, how that scene cuts from there to that overhead shot.
Oh, well, beautiful shot where it's about the 30th minute where it just goes off to that LA shot.
Yeah.
And the great film critic Manola Dargis, who joined us several times on this journey, she said, Blake, this is the kind of romance, the lie that we accept in Michael Mann movies. For all its authenticity, we have to believe that a graphic designer has that view. And I said, and ever since then, I've never been able to watch that scene in Heat without going, you know, we allow our romantic, you know, fantasy elements in Michael Mann movies, and it's when a graphic designer can afford that view. That's, we'll let that go. That's totally
But, you know, I mean, it's also the instance where that, you know, the film kind of elevates to a different, more romantic, you know, more heightened lyrical plane. It was completely just mesmerizing and, you know, kind of bewitching to me. It was at that moment, that cut between them and the diner and this kind of very extreme wide shot, really.
Yeah.
That were put under a spell. I was definitely put under a spell.
Yes.
At that moment. And, you know, I think it's one of, you know, many moments in the film is like, this is not your typical action film. And I'm not even an action film, you know, aficionado. But if I were going to make an action film, I would, this is what inspired me to want to attempt to do that.
I just wanted to say that usually talking to you right now, I'm in, you know, you're an inspiring filmmaker and it's exciting to talk to you. And I would just say this, I always say that the worst nightmare that I have is people, usually other filmmakers, especially very bro-y filmmakers, film bro filmmakers, start out and they say, I want to, you know, I'm inspired by Heat. I want to make my version of Heat. And then you watch the film and you go, did you watch Heat? Like, did you understand what it even was? And speaking to you right now, I'm going to say unequivocally, I'm like, if there's anyone who says I was inspired by Heat and I wanted to make a film and approach it, just even those few lines that you just said about the, like, the elevated experience that you have in this mesmerizing dreamlike state that you have at this specific nexus of the movie, about it taking to this new romantic, you know, emotional space and heightened, you know, level of emotionality for all of the characters, because it's really this part that starts coinciding across everything. We're seeing Chris with Charlene, we're seeing, you know, the Diane Venora Justine relationship with Vincent, and how that's been and all these sorts of things that are being unfolding. So I can say with confidence, when you say it, I get excited. I don't just go, oh no, for the love of God, don't say it.
Now I feel the pressure.
I'm sorry. That comes with being good. Like, it happens, right? This is what's going to have to happen. But I'm just like, Isabel actually gets it. She actually gets what it is about. But I love this scene so much. I found this in, and you were just talking a little bit earlier before we pivoted into this scene, just about what I was shocked and what I was shocked initially, but I guess as the journey of this project went on, the most sought after scene for anyone to want to talk about in the entire film, by far, not the heist, not the diner conversation, the finale. I had like 9 people say, Blake, I have to talk about the tunnel. I have to talk about the tunnel. Like, you were just referencing it. We didn't even mention what scene it was, but I knew exactly what you were talking about, which is that tunnel sequence where Nate gives him that call. You're home free. Yep, home free. Hangs the phone up. He's sitting there next to Amy Brenneman's beautiful face, this gorgeous wide shot. The tunnel lights change. And then De Niro's face in all its like minutia, like this like Stradivarius level of facial gestures that just play. And then the choice is made. And it's just like that became almost like a, it's like a metaphor for the entire movie, is that choice in that tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like the parallel of that moment in my own film Lingua Franca is, remember the slow dance scene kind of?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
And, you know, they, the small talk about the passport and as she's like resting her, her chin on his shoulders, just that dawning realization, in his face. And it's those moments I'm like, wow, because those, I think, in the action genre, or you know, in American cinema, mainstream American cinema, typically where there's really no patience, you know, for these kinds of ruminative, meditative moments where, you know, characters are coming to the realization. But that when you include that in a genre that seemingly kind of shuns those kinds of moments, it's jolting. It's, you know, jarring because, and it lends the action kind of just more humanity and more emotional weight. And, you know, that's the thing with Heat 2 in general, is that all the characters, and Mann has said this himself, like he invested the characters with enough, he makes the audience invest emotionally in each of those characters, that anything that happens to them leaves a sort of emotional impact on the audience. Even like, especially notable is Dennis Haysbert's, you know, character, really just the getaway driver that in other films, you know, he doesn't get his own arc.
Or subplot. He doesn't even get a mention. He just gets shot and it's over.
Exactly.
And like, and even the pivot of like Trejo, who is such an important character for the whole movie, that the baton pass, you know, that could just be all like, get another driver and like another movie. And you can just totally see that some folks who are anchored to this cat and just to the pure, like, I guess you'd say like the most elemental, like stripped down version of Heat, you know, and he got to make it as LA Takedown, the TV movie. It's like people are like, well, why didn't LA Takedown work? It's like, because you've seen a lot of these tropes before. They're not elevated to this next level where there's an emotional tapestry of every character. So as soon as Trejo hands over, you're like, oh my God, is there a betrayal of it? And you have no time to think. So the, you know, how it carries through to those things. But by the time, you know, when Neil goes up to Dennis Haysbert's character there, Don, in the kitchen, you're like, oh God, it's so heartbreaking that he's going to do it, but it's even more heartbreaking that, you know, from the moment he has that drink in that bar on that first day, that he's gonna say yes. He's not gonna hesitate, he's going to do it. And I love what you said before, that Chekhovian sort of ramifications, the ramifications of small conversations are so good, just like little things. It makes me think of Mikey and Nikki too. It's like, you know, how bad Mikey and Nikki, you know, Elaine May's great film, you know how bad their relationship is going to get in like an hour and a half before any of it goes bad. Just in a couple of little, the way that they interact with each other and the way he parries off a conversation here or there with one another, and they're just that great Falk and Cassavetes energy because they're such great friends, and it's just electric, and you're like, oh, this is going to go so bad. It's going to go so bad, and I have to, I'm entangled now. I have to see it. I have to see how bad it gets.
And, you know, also what's surprising to me about Heat is that despite its seeming reserve, you know, and kind of very seemingly detached filmmaking, it's about the thrill of the chase, you know, and it's an exhilarating film about, you know, these two characters who are just in the relish and the gusto with which they pursue each other. In a way, it's kind of like an immoral or film in that it doesn't necessarily concern itself with a conventional morality of what's right, you know, what's wrong. We're with both characters. And we are equally invested in each of their pursuit, you know, as one, the thief, and as the police. And that's what complicates the film too, emotionally, that it's not one protagonist, and it's not, the orthodox kind of dramatic orientation that we're used to. In the same way, I think that's also what made Face Off, you know?
Yes.
Really riveting. And I think didn't Face Off like come out the year after?
Yeah.
Heat came out in 95.
We've got Point Break, and then you've got Heat, and you've got Face Off, and there's lots of great two huge actors going against each other and the quandary of the chase. You know, I think Point Break and, I mean, another great LA movie, but, and Catherine Bigelow, just like a kind of unabashed, you know, like affrontingly so that you're like, these guys are, there's a love story happening. There's a real central, there's a real central magnetic connection. And, you know, people joke about it with Heat, and I'm like, every take is valid. Every take is valid. It is kind of a love story. And some of it is kind of tragic. As you said, the thrill of the chase, it doesn't, they're not, Vincent doesn't do any kind of self-reflection on why the chase, like, outwardly is so important to him. But it's like, this is a guy who saves his stepdaughter from a suicide, has an attempted reconciliation with Justine, and then looks at his pager and knows about Neil McCauley and says, I could stay. And Justine lets him go, and she stays back crumbling, and he skips down those stairs. He just is ready to get back into the chase. And it's one of, that's another one of the magnificent and tragic scenes of the movie, is because he just can't, he, like, we're with him going down the stairs, but man is so quick to remind us, like, hey, there are consequences. There's a toll that's being paid with every character, and all debts are being collected by the end of this thing.
It's funny, I also used to joke to my friends that, you know, like, 3 years later they remade this into capery, you know, fun movie, but with Jennifer Lopez and George Clooney.
Yes.
They're fucking instead of killing each other.
But and you know what? And you know what? Some would say that was a better idea. It's definitely a great movie.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, wow. My God, I feel like, why am I becoming speechless? I just think about it. Like, and
this is the trap. Unfortunately, you know, my co-host Katie Walsh and I also do a podcast on Miami Vice, which we call Miami Nice, which is a which we both love unashamedly. But that is also a really horny and romantic movie. And some people are like, you know, they're like, oh, these, you know, it's got these love stories and things like that. You know, actually, the whole thing's a love story. So let's just squash that now. It's not even a thriller. It's not a undercover story. It's a love story. It's an entangled love story, and it has all this heightened action and emotion, and exactly as you said, these like pregnant moments that have great contemplation. And Michael Mann's a filmmaker who seems to effortlessly weave those things together in mainstream genre films, and that's what elevates them, and that's what, why people take notice, and why filmmakers like yourself get inspired by them or transfixed by them and go, oh, if I'm ever going to approach it, Michael Mann gave me a template that I don't have to do this rote stuff. I can actually do something that's way more interesting to me, which is find the reality and the humanity in these things.
Exactly. And, you know, ultimately, I feel like, you know, he is very much in control of the emotional experience that he wants to create in the audience. And at the end of the day, you know, that's, you know, what we're watching movies for. We're not necessarily remembering, you know, the characters and their quirks, you know, and what they're saying to each other. But what we'll never forget is how certain movies make us feel.
Yeah.
That very unique, I think, emotional experience that we get from specific auteurs, you know, like with Wong Kar-wai, for instance, a very different director.
But nonetheless, transfixing, and you'd never forget how you feel when you watch one of his films.
Yeah, there's just a kind of a very just swoony and glorious kind of melancholy and heartbreak that you get from watching a World Korea film. That's what draws us, you know, and pulls us back over and over again each time he makes a film. And with Michael Mann, for me, it's that, you know, he uses the heist movie, he uses kind of the chase movie to, you know, focus on these love stories. And it's it's something that you don't expect in that particular genre. That's very, you know, like explosions, you know, machismo.
And, yeah.
You know, while these characters have that, you know, that hard, tough exterior, they're really softies.
Yes.
You know, they're very sensitive, emotional men that are hiding behind this gruff facade. And, you know, those cracks in the armor are what makes, one of the things that makes a Michael Mann a sly and subtle emotional master of cinema.
Yes. Couldn't agree more. And yeah. the big thing that you just said also is, I don't know if it's an Australianism, but there's a phrase that we use sometimes. It's like, we need a good cry. You know, we need a good cry. And I think that Wong Kar-wai, or those filmmakers who have that, can touch and immediately enrapture you with that melancholy. They've just kind of got it on a string for you.
Yeah.
It's like you just focus in and you're like, I need a good cry. So it's time for In the Mood for Love. You know, it's just like, it's time for something. I need a good, like, I need to be played like a fiddle here. I need to just have a cry and love and love heartbreak and then be okay when the credits roll. That, like, that was just an experience. And I think that, you know, I think so many things get just taken into those little pockets. And very recently, you know, a film that for the biggest compliment I can give it made me feel a little bit like that, a contemporary kind of thief riff, is Aubrey Plaza's Emily the Criminal. Was another one that was just a lot of space for contemplation and talking about personal value and identification and, like, trying to find, you know, break out and be independent and those sorts of things, and then getting entangled with mobsters. And the whole time I was just thinking, like, this is someone who gets it. This is someone who's, like, taking a genre elements because it gives us the familiarity of momentum, but has no qualms about saying, stop, this is where my film is different. For this moment, for this love story, for this quandary, for this situation. Yeah. And I think I'm all for that. I'm like, I don't know why we just don't make 100 more movies that have a genre bent and then just let talented filmmakers like you just go off and do whatever they want to do to make their version of that.
I recently saw Emily the Criminal on a plane.
It's not a wide scope heat. You don't have to feel embarrassed. It's not like watching something that has been shot on this huge Panavision or VistaVision cameras. It is a small movie, but I felt it played really well.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, Aubrey Plaza was spectacular in it.
Yes.
You know, one other thing that I want to talk about that I love about Heat and Thief as well is, you know, just Michael Mann's fascination with process. Just staying with the characters, especially in Thief, as they're, you know, opening up that door with the magnesium. And
one of the greatest scenes ever in cinema.
Yes, absolutely. And and that's why what made me watch Le Cercle Rouge, actually, too, in that it's kind of a very deliberate and single-minded fixation on how things are done.
Yes.
And kind of very boldly stating that this is what makes for a thrilling cinema. You know, you know, no one's getting shot.
No.
No cars, you know, no, you know, automobiles are exploding, but just, you know, these characters very much loving what they do and being enamored with it, how to get from point A to point B to point C and point D, and expecting and demanding us as an audience to be just as riveted by it. I think it's...
Le Cercle Rouge, you know, whether it's a... there's a great French film critic, Jean-Baptiste Thoret, who talks about Mann's influences. And even though Mann doesn't sort of outwardly, like some other filmmakers, say, oh, you know, I took from this, or I was really influenced by that, seems a bit more of a sponge. But, you know, Le Cercle Rouge, you watch that film and you're like, this has to be, it almost like, it's like Melville has to be a man guy. Like, you know, I think that that's a phrase that you say, oh, he's one of my guys or she's one of my gals. Like that's, yeah. I've got a season ticket for this filmmaker. But Les Okereke, the thing that even gets me every time is the scene where the guy takes his shoes off so that he can walk up the stairs quietly after staging the walk in.
Yes.
And
yes.
not get heard. And
yeah.
it's just that. It's like not even the aiming to shoot the little thing through, to do it all, to to cinch up the security, to have everything that they need to do. And it's not even just that. It's just like one guy taking his shoes off so that people can't hear him walking up and down the marble stairs and clomping along. I'm like, that's it. Like, that's everything. That's, you know, and even, you know, James Caan, it's like even the first safe, you know, how he has to go through and then get a hammer to knock this through. It's just like all those little details. It's like you're telling so much about that character and who they are and what their headspace is. And in Man movies and Melvilles, they are so precise. They are a well-oiled machine and things will go down the way that they're going to go down. And then it leaves you on knife's edge, like, oh my God, when is this going to go wrong? Or what's the thing that's going to disrupt them? And then when they conquer it or they don't, that's so much part of the thrill.
Exactly. And, you know, just the movie kind of like stops in its tracks to like just let you yeah. be immersed in that moment. And like, as you said, you know, it's, you know, those tiny details, like taking off the shoes, that, you know, you don't typically get to see. And other movies have this type that lends it texture, you know, dimension. And that's texture that makes it feel more real. And that I also said that, you know, it's in those moments that the circle illusion, like Man and Thief, you know, with the opening of the safe, like feels like a documentary.
Yes. Well, I think all of the guys certainly felt like it was a documentary when he's standing there, James Caan, with the best thieves in Chicago, yeah. who are actually with him. That, you know, it's not the actors or stuntmen that are in the other mask. Yeah. It's actually real safecrackers that Man has right. Got as technical advisors who are helping him uh-huh. open this safe with the metal. So, yeah, it's like that sequence where you're watching it all get cut in real time and no speeding up, no cheating.
Yeah.
Like if we're going to do this, we're going to set this thing on fire. We're going to cut through this metal. We're going to watch that molten steel come down.
Yeah.
It's just electric.
Right. Did he write Heat on his own? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, he did. Okay. Yeah. He wrote, it was written. It's been written. I think the earliest that you can track it back is, you know, kind of 80s. Yeah, is 80s Circa yeah. Thief meeting Chuck Adamson and then going and doing Crime Story and all those things. And it was always being iterated from that time. And then it was like post Miami Vice, he gets a chance to make LA Takedown, and that's late 80s and he's still making it. But it was like early 80s, even 70s, the earliest idea. And then by, you know, 95, he thought he cracked the script. And he was going to yeah. hand it off to someone else. Maybe his good buddy, Walter Hill, who's my great friend, Walter Chaw, wrote his amazing compendium behind me. And Art Linton thankfully convinced him that that was a really silly idea and he had to make it himself because it was his opus. So,
yeah, because I always find it fascinating. I feel like, you know, especially kind of the trajectory from the very first film, you know, of the director, which has a very, very bold, you know, distinct idea. And how over the course of their career, there's one movie that becomes, I guess, the most, you know, the perfect, perhaps most pure and most elegant distillation or articulation of the idea that was put forth in their debut. And I think, yeah, I mean, there's a direct line from Thief to Heat, you know, some of the central concepts, clearly, I mean, even the language, like home free.
Yeah.
It's in Thief.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Heat, you know, just the it is also Ramachan. But I guess what evolved there too is the philosophy of the protagonist, you know, which I kind of touched on earlier, in that, you know, Frank in Thief is tempted, you know, by secular attractions of family, relationship, But, you know, Neil kind of wanders like a moth closer to the flame, but ultimately extricates himself, you know, from that faith and kind of, you know, becomes a monk. And at the end, you know, in his, at the moment of his death, he achieves that nirvana.
Yes.
That he was going after. Like, he didn't go back to prison.
I was never going back.
And he manages to essentially liberate and emancipate himself from this mortal coil. And that handshake between, you know, Neil and Vincent Hanna at that pivot, you know, at that very crucial moment is like both of them have achieved, you know, what they had set out to accomplish. Vincent Hanna got what he was going after, and it is,
and it's crushing.
Happy ending. Yeah,
it's happy, but it's also crushing because it's like that devastation of like, I told you I was never going back, and I've never heard it put that way, but I think you're so spot on that it's like he has achieved nirvana because according to his code, despite all of the infractions that he's made, he's like, the one thing that he said is like, I'm never going back. Like, I will never go back to that. I would rather die. It's either die or live in this fantasy that I've, you know, this, I've kind of, I'm the architect of a fantasy, Fiji, New Zealand, whatever it is. Like, he's the architect of that fantasy. And it's like, I'm going to do this or I'm going to die. And then once he holds Vincent's hand, he says, I told you I was never going back. And Vincent says, yeah. And he sort of slips away. That next shot is the one that gets me every time. And I've seen this movie,
yeah,
I mean, as many times as one of the editors of Heat has seen this movie at this point. But that's the crushing weight of his ascension, if you like, to that kind of nirvana state is like Vincent going, I don't go to that same nirvana. Like it's not what's left for me. Like, what's the exultant state? Because now this person who is like the most person that's like me in the world or in the universe has achieved this state, and now I'm alone.
Yeah. But he also helped that person achieve that state. So in a way,
true.
You know, he was the instrument.
Yeah.
And the tool to facilitate that ascension for Neil McCauley. And that's, I don't know. I was, you know, but the last time I saw that, that's when I kind of realized, you know, that, I guess, very, very Eastern, you know, kind of worldview, and just relinquishing and the abnegation of these material ties and entanglements. Because I think ultimately relate to that as well. I don't know, just I'm not the type to like, let's just say I'm like a weird person. And I think also being just an introvert, and that there are times, you know, as a filmmaker that, you know, just, you know, entertaining this fantasy of living my life, just pursuing filmmaking and nothing else, like a nun or a monk. And I was thinking at first, you know, being trans, you know, not growing up like straight and like having to be subjected to or pressured to conform to certain kind of life milestones that, you know, my peers are subjected to. Like, maybe there is a life, you know, where like a cloistered nun or a monk that I can just pursue making films, you know, my whole life without any other distractions.
Well, if you keep busy enough, that's what happens. Your life just becomes monk-like because you go from distillation of an idea into your next essay on that idea or a new idea or a new patch, and you just keep working and you'll feel like a monk because you won't get to have conversations like this because you're on set doing something and you're out and you don't. It is. You're going from
one thing. I feel like Michael Mann is more sentimental than me because he's actually allowing Neil, you know, like, okay, I'm actually going to get close to this other person.
Yes.
And then, you know, at just, you know, the right moment to be the most heartbreaking, walk away from that as they're looking at me devastated and like, totally crushed.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is. You also touched on one thing which we haven't talked about with Frank and Neil, is that there's a great, like, as you said, it's like you start the thesis in your first films. And this is why it's like great to go back to, you go back and watch like Blood Simple, and then you watch all Coen Brothers movies later. Or you even like Shallow Grave with Danny Boyle, very fun filmmaker. And you go back and watch like his little peccadilloes through the rest of his career. It's really fun.
Yeah.
But that, Jimmy Khan's Frank is so like his performance as a civilian, his car salesman, is so flashy. You know, it's that great scene with Tuesday World. I wear, you know, $600 slacks, you know, I change cars, like guys change their fucking suit.
Right.
And he's going crazy. And, but I love that, that perfection of this monk like person later with Neil is, I'm going to strip away all of that. So, like with Frank, he's got the beautiful house and, you know, it's even got that great Jim Belushi scene. It was like, look at this big tree and look at this house. Look at this. But Neil's like most immaculate view, but it is a, it is like an operating theater. He's away. He's detached. He doesn't even have more than two cups. You know, he's completely attached. So there's disentangled. So he has all of that later that he's like, this is just another iteration of this. It's like a honing or an orthodoxy of a very particular philosophy that he's just going to do that. And now this is that perfect distillation of that. And some people love the Frank because of the extremity of his choices, but Neil's like much more consistent about like, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to approach it. And he's more of a romantic. Frank's like, let's cut out the Mickey Mouse bullshit and get on with this big romance. And Neil's more like, oh, are you alone? You know?
Yeah. And how he's saying initially, like, you know, I'm alone. I'm not lonely. And then admitting that afterwards. But you know that his famous, his iconic line in Heat, like 30 seconds, you know? You have 30 seconds to like, you know, leave whatever, you know, wife or family, whatever you can't walk, you know, out on, you know, in 30 seconds. And so that's essentially kind of like what happens in the final act of Thief, and somehow that wisdom, you know, or that philosophy is passed on from the Michael Mann alter ego in Thief to to Michael, to Heat, you know, with Neil McCauley. And I also watched the first half of Collateral as well, and, you know, Tom Cruise is also named Vincent.
Also named Vincent, but dresses like Neil McCauley and has the silver fox look and the every, you know, very easily ignored person look of just gray suit, gray hair, sunglasses, businessman. Okay, I barely have to scratch the surface with this person. That's how he turns invisible, is to look exactly like Neil McCauley.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, Vincent, you know, and he essentially becoming Ian McCauley. And I think, you know, is that a man's subliminal way of saying that, you know, the Vincent character in Heat has become disillusioned with government and politics and seemingly turned over to the other side.
Just flipped the switch. No, I think that, I think that's a nice, like, You can tell Stuart Beattie makes this like punchy, it's originally set in New York, Russian mafia script. And then Michael Mann takes it and says, no, it's being set in LA and it's going to be the cartels. And just so much of his like psychology and philosophy for characters is just like imprinted on this guy. It's just like that, you know, he's got the flash of Vincent Hanna. He's got the cool of Neil McCauley. It's because then Jamie Foxx gets to play this brilliant, you know, downtrodden outsider and just have to be a witness to all of his mayhem. Yeah. And it's a completely different dynamic, but it's super fun. It's the most audience relatable character, Max, in Collateral, because so many of these people are living their heightened existences. And the great thing about Max is that he's not until tonight that you're watching Collateral, you know, such a brilliant flick. Got a lot of time for Collateral.
Fascinating man cinematic universe. although I'm thinking, do you know if the Jamie Foxx character in Collateral has any precedent in any of Mann's earlier works? Or does he feel like a completely new kind of character?
Well, he's got a couple of things in common. Like, funnily enough, he's probably got a lot in common with an Edie. You know, he's a dreamer. He's running a small business. Right. But he also has some Macaulay stuff, too, and some Frank stuff, like the whole postcards, look into a fantasy life. And so yes. he has some right. of those things. Right. But he hasn't. It's been harder for him, and it almost you'd almost have to go back to like Jericho to see like a guy who was put in a situation and but is actually a fairly normal person who's just trying to get their life back on track and gets put into these, you know, huge things. But no, he's kind of new. He's a unique character because then he's kind of forced. He's almost like this, you know, very tangible, real person who's outside. He gets forced into something that is kind of unwitting. And like, it's not like Breeden, who actually has the expertise and is down, and it's kind of tragic. It's like, it's you are completely held hostage through this thing. So yeah, he's definitely new. He's definitely newer than those other characters, but he's got little color. The man color is the postcard, the Fiji. As soon as you see Fiji, you're like, oh man, like, I don't know. This guy's called Vincent. This guy's looking at a postcard and fantasizing about Fiji. It's like, those are those little thematic elements that man like fused, you know, whether, you know, by hook or by crook to Stuart Beattie's script. And you're like, that's what he's kind of built into there. But that's, you know, that's, it's almost like that thing of, and I imagine with yourself that you would find this, it's like, if you read someone else's script and you were going to shoot it, all of your personal, you know, references, all of your personal, you know, philosophy, all of the things that maybe are under-exaggerated in the script, you like, blow into huge scenes because you're like, this is actually what the movie is to me. I just feel like a director, unless you're kind of going in as a director for hire or something like that, you know, a great filmmaker will grab something and just like they put their stamp on it. So I feel like that's what Mann did with that script. He's like, all that other stuff that you can just, you know, whether it's casting these people, wardrobe choices, looks, little kind of silent moments that are probably under written in the script, he's like, no, he's going to do this and he's going to look at that and this is the way he's going to do it. It's all there.
Yeah. And it's fascinating how these characters seem to be stuck in a perpetual limbo, you know, where they're kind of trying to transition from one place to the other. In Thief, it's from Chicago to California.
Yes.
And Heat, now it's from California to New Zealand for Frank. And in Collateral, for the Jamie Foxx character, it's from LA to the Maldives, but they never actually get there. And so because of that perpetual limbo, they're bound to be reborn, reincarnated again. And I wonder what, you know, the next installment in that particular Mann film would be. I'm very curious about Ferrari.
Yeah,
well, but I don't think it's, you know, I don't think he wrote it, right? It's not based on his idea.
He's been working, he's been developing it for a long time. But I don't think he wrote it. No, I think you're right there. But he's definitely been working on it for a long, long time. And I think we can all get excited when Michael Mann is making a movie. I think that that's the, when those big filmmakers that we love so much, like, make something new, it's like, oh my God, I can't wait. Please don't just go to streaming. I would love to see this on a big screen. I really want to see it. So yeah, we've it's now finished filming. And apparently we're imminently about to hear about the prospect of Heat 2 and casting announcements and things like that. So very exciting times ahead for us Mann fans, just very briefly.
Yeah. Looking forward. Hopefully Ferrari premieres in Cannes or Venice.
There you go. Hopefully you're there.
Yeah. I'm going to Cannes this year. So I'm excited about that. Have you been? I've been a few times, right?
Never been to Cannes. I would love to go to Cannes. And maybe I should have tried to plan. If I knew Ferrari was going to be there, I might, that might have had to have been the go. Look,
it's not too late, Blake.
It's not too late. Well, thanks. I'll have to tell my family that I'll be gone in May to go to Cannes again. Sorry, family. Isabel said it was fine, so I should do that. This has been an absolute treat talking to you. I'm such a fan of your work and I'm such a fan of your list of choices. I would love to talk about everything that is on this list, but it's really special to bring, you know, another man acolyte such as yourself into our One Heat Minute family. So welcome to the crew, and it's been an absolute pleasure. And I can't wait for everything else that you're doing, but particularly you mentioned on, again, My Favorite Year, great podcast from a friend of the show, Jason Bailey. You were talking about a noir film and I got so excited and I immediately actually was texting Jason going, I love this episode. It's so great. A noir film from Isabel. Oh my God. Yeah. Great. Great. So we're so looking forward to that. And just, yeah, thank you so much for being a part of the show. It's really, really awesome to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be part of this community.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.